Thank you all for coming. And I should say I'm not responsible for the timing of this lecture. So I thank you for coming at this time. And I was supposed to tell you that that you can Twitter if you like. I'm not sure why I'm supposed to tell you this, since I don't Twitter. But anyhow, here it is. And so in this special anniversary of ESA, it is a pleasure and a privilege to give this lecture. And I'd like to start then with a historical debate on the factors that determine population abundance, a well-known debate that that all of you know. But I have some quotes here on the one side from those that emphasize the role of regulating factors, the balance of animal populations, represented by Nicholson, who wrote the mechanism of density governments is always intraspecific competition. And he referred to the fallacy of the argument that the close association between the population densities of animals and changes in climate would then imply that climate is wholly responsible for the determination of densities. At the opposite end, we have those that emphasize fluctuations in population abundance, represented here by this quote of Andreatta and Birch, who said that density-dependent factors are not a general theory because, as we have seen, they do not describe any substantial body of empirical facts. And they went on to say, not only did we fail to find a density-dependent factor, but we also showed that there was no room for one. Do not worry, in the hour I was given, I do not intend to review the research that followed, which was enormous, discussions on terms, definitions, statistical methods. I merely wanted to say that as all dichotomies, they never die, and they recur under different faces. In particular, we have after the 1950s, I think in the 1980s and 90s, the exciting work on chaos versus noise, which was very similar in some respects, and regardless of what it of the conclusions on chaos, generated a lot of understanding on nonlinear dynamics and development of methods for time series. And closer to home in epidemiology, which it's nice to see, it's more and more a subdiscipline of ecology. We have this debate in the 90s and 2000s on intrinsic dynamics versus extrinsic climatic factors. And there is nothing new, so if you read the earlier literature on cholera in the early 1900s, very heated debates of those opposing environment, the localists versus the contagionists, who were more focused on transmission. So the debate, the recent debate, was very much about interannual variability. And to illustrate the kinds of patterns I'm talking about, I will use cholera here, a disease that is no longer a concern here in the developed world, but is present in over 70 countries, including Bangladesh, where these surveillance data come from. And you see different strains, but what I want to show in this surveillance record is basically that the seasonal epidemics, two per year, change dramatically in size from one year to the next in the form of cycles 2 to 8 years, which have led to questions on the role of climate, for example, El Niño Southern Oscillation. And there have been critics, represented here again by a quote, longer-term weather cycles such as ENSO have been invoked recently to explain outbreaks of malaria and other diseases. None of these analyses allows an alternative explanation involving intrinsic cycles. This was largely about malaria. And for malaria, where we expect the strongest signal of climate is at the edge of its spatial distribution. This is not surprising, since it is here that limiting factors are exactly temperature and rainfall, respectively. And here we have patterns of the so-called unstable malaria, very dynamic patterns, illustrated on the right with a plot, two surveillance records from plantations in Kenya, where you see again the variation in size of epidemics once intensity of transmission has increased from the 70s to the 90s. And the debates here have involved not just climate variability, but climate change. Now, to understand what is meant by these alternative explanations that involve intrinsic cycles, it is useful to go to very well-known mathematical models for the transmission of disease, which have been the basis of very elegant studies in childhood diseases, primarily measles. And you know these models, they divide the population in compartments for susceptible, infected, and recovered individuals. And there is a strong analogy to consumer resource systems. The consumer are the resources. The infected host are the, sorry, the resources are the susceptibles, the consumer are the infected, and immunity is the main mechanism that mediates depletion of the resource. So we know very well from the early studies that as an epidemic develops in red, the susceptible resource decreases in numbers, and when you get below a threshold, you have the epidemic turn around. You cannot start another cycle until you replete the resource through birth or immigration, and so on. These cycles decay towards equilibrium, but noise and seasonality allows them to persist. Now, if you add seasonal transmission, you have now the possibility of two interacting cycles, and we know that in these nonlinear systems, this leads to all sorts of at least potential dynamics, including in particular the emergence of cycles at periods that are not present in the forcing. And this is what was involved in the discussions. For example, in the plots on measles, pre-vaccination, the well-known biennial cycle, a small year followed by a large one here, a period two in the complete absence of a driver. And of course, the non-linearity comes in these systems from this transmission rate, the total transmission rate, which, I'm trying to find the pointer, which is similar to a Lotka-Volterra term. It's just this product. So this has been proposed, these intrinsic cycles, as explaining not just malaria, but dengue, and it has been studied mathematically very, very nicely in terms of resonance dynamics. Now here, what I wanted to do today was to basically do a synthesis from our own case studies on malaria and cholera. And to do this, I have this a simple diagram to organize a little bit the synthesis. On the x-axis, you have transmission intensity. And we know from these diseases that the variability we are trying to explain, variability in the number of infections, in fact, decreases to the right. So there is less to explain to the right. At the same time, in white, you see that the depletion of the resource, the depletion of susceptible hosts, increases in the opposite direction. So from this, we would expect that the signal of climate forcing should be the strongest to the left, with a confounding effect of the role of population dynamics to the right, with the strength of competition and nonlinear feedbacks within the system getting stronger to the right until there is nothing to explain because we have very little variability and basically immunity is just dumping the cycles. But the picture is not that clear because in all these diseases, well, they do not fit this picture of simple oscillators. In fact, when we move to the right, we have also higher parasite diversity. This is the antigenic diversity seen by the immune system, which mediates competition. We also have more distributed levels of immunity, and we need re-exposure, continuous re-exposure, to maintain protection to disease and protection to infection. So it would be more similar in consumer resource systems to not just increasing diversity, but more complex pathways of biomass flows moving to the right. So the paradigm from measles, does, in terms of how these systems respond to forcing, does not necessarily apply. And what I'd like to show you today is some evidence for a very clear role of climate at both interannual and longer decadal variation in these diseases that are environmentally driven, but to show that immunity population dynamics, they matter in ways that differ from those originally expected, and to touch on some frontiers of climate-driven disease dynamics in changing human landscapes. I will do this with, you don't have to read all this in particular, I think you don't see the screen from the back, but, and it seems to come, is it a way to, okay, it just seems to go into saving, power saving, so anyhow, you can see, I will do this with three examples in different parts of the world, starting with cholera and climate variability in Bangladesh, asking about the role of ENSO and flooding, whether they drive population dynamic, but also at what spatial scale do we have to consider the spatial heterogeneities in large cities. then moved to desert malaria and variability in rainfall in northwest India, and again asked whether population dynamics matter or is it just about monsoon rains. Then touched on highland malaria and warmer temperatures in Ethiopia, and this will be about climate change, not climate variability, to ask whether a consideration of population dynamics also can help unravel the interaction between climate and intervention. And end with some theoretical considerations when we move to the right towards higher transmission intensities where we expect these nonlinear feedbacks to be stronger. And I wanted to point out that all these case studies are in parts of the world that are highly populated. So let me start with cholera, where the interest in climate factors was largely motivated by the recognition that the pathogen survives outside the human host in aquatic environments, brackish water, estuaries, in places where humans interact actively with these aquatic environments. And this is a disease of fecal oral transmission. You see open latrines in the background behind this fisherman. And this is one of the exploratory results that got us going and initially, but here for both a rural area on top, south of Dhaka, and Dhaka itself. And it is a map I like a lot. If you didn't know what it was, you would think that this is a map of an El Nino event. It isn't. It is a map of rank correlations between the cases in the post-monsoon peak in cholera correlated with each grid point of the global oceans for sea surface temperatures. And the region of positive correlations in red that are statistically significant are found in the tropical Pacific, exactly where we see the warming with El Nino. So this is also true for Dhaka, and it occurs for the winter sea surface temperatures. But this is correlation, so does it hold when we allow for consideration of population dynamics? We have been interested in this question for a while, and in particular in ways we can go from the observation of cases to the respective role of these two factors for these nonlinear and partially observed systems using models and statistical methods. And we started indeed with methods that were derived from the study of chaos with attractor reconstruction, then went to a bit more mechanistic models in the work with Katia Cole, and then more recently in collaboration with the very nice methods that Eda Ioannidis and Aaron King developed, we went to use more process-based models to encapsulate different hypotheses. And this is one example where we see again the cholera patterns in the top graph for one of the for the dominant strain together with an intermittent outbreak of a strain that has gone away. And then the driver here will be the El Nino Southern Oscillation during the winter. And the kinds of models we use are variations of a theme we all know, the variations of these SIR models, as illustrated here, mainly to note that we have a loss of immunity in cholera that is allowed so individuals can return to the class S. They can also be protected from disease, from the main strain by exposure to the classical strain. And then I wanted to point out that the rate of transmission, this force of infection per susceptible individual, so this is the consumption rate in the system, has a long-term trend, a term that includes seasonality and El Nino, and then transmission from the environment, but also the nonlinear sort of density-dependent term, here with an exponent, and I'll return to that exponent. So we fit these models with these computational statistical methods, which allow you to compare hypotheses with some model selection criteria based on likelihoods. And in this case, the main result was that the model with El Nino was the best model, regardless of consideration of epidemiology. And interestingly, there was no long-term immunity supported by the data, so in fact, there is no depletion of susceptible that is important over multiple time scales, but there is an interesting effect of this exponent alpha, which is below one, and introduces a mechanism that curtails the explosiveness of these epidemics, but at a seasonal time scale. So these epidemics are very explosive. If you don't have this exponent, they go extinct. So this mechanism allows for persistence of epidemic. It can represent either changes in behavior over short time scales, but it can also represent a rapid depletion of susceptibles at scales that are not represented here. And we know from theoretical studies that when we go from individual-based models that are stochastic to these aggregated population models, it is possible to capture the effect of these heterogeneities with these kind of modifications in the functional form. So again, no depletion of susceptible at the large scale, no possibility of those intrinsic cycles, but an interesting within-season mechanism for persistence of the disease. So of course, all of this is very nice in these rural areas, which is a group of villages, but what about the city of Dhaka? This is an enormous city with enormous socioeconomic heterogeneity. And of course, when we work with time series originally, the data were aggregated because we think that climate is a regional driver. But again, these are, in a socioeconomic sense, very heterogeneous environments. In Dhaka itself, we have more than 14 million people projected to double in the next 25 years. So we obtained the data at the level of the districts of the city, as illustrated here in this map, differentiating the core of the city in orange, the older districts, the periphery in blue. And we proceeded to use a very phenomenological approach because we were very happy to see this data, but if you look at it, then the system at this level is very stochastic, with cases appearing, disappearing locally, so very lots of extinctions. So we use a metapopulation model effectively that classifies cholera into low, medium, and high levels. And this is a stochastic model, basically to ask whether grouping the districts into the core and the periphery, which had shown from exploratory analysis to be different, would be important. And in fact, the probabilities of transition between these three states were a function of the group, the seasons, the neighboring states, and the climate covariates here, ENSO and flooding. And to, again, make a long story short, the effect of these groups was the most important of all the factors and was extremely important to capture the dynamics of the data. Now, this is perhaps not surprising. We started blindly from the temporal and spatial data. If we had looked at the city from remote sensing or any other structural mapping, we would see, as here, where we have classified from Landsat images the environment into urban, water, and rural, that in fact, the core of the city is the true city in the sense of density and living environment. So the densities here reach up to 100,000 people per kilometer square, and we could see associations of these two regions to a number of socioeconomic factors. But here, I wanted to point out that having seen this pattern, we can now zoom out, aggregate at this natural scale, and now use the kinds of models we are comfortable fitting to this kind of data once we have less extinction. So we have the core and the periphery with similar models, as I showed you before, coupled by movement and then driven by ENSO. And the main result I wanted to show is that when we look at the dynamics at this level, you see immediately differences in seasonality, but the model allows us to estimate the force of infection. This is the rate of infection per individual host that you would feel if you are in the city versus if you are in the periphery. And the main point is that in the city, you have a force of infection that is an order of magnitude higher than in the periphery per individual, and that the second peak is much more variable. This is where you feel the climate variability, which is not apparent in the periphery. So the core functions as this sensitive part of the city that then spreads to the rest. And this is not unique to cholera. If you consider a completely different disease, rotavirus, which we do not list as necessarily climate sensitive, we don't think of it that way, But again, if we look at the city this way, we see two different regions, we see two different seasonalities, and here we have to use a model that is a bit different with structure levels of immunity because children get protection through repeated re-exposure. Well, here too, a child that is in the center of the city will see a risk of infection that is an order of magnitude higher than in the periphery. And the seasonality is different. The second peak, the monsoon peak, that in this model is driven by flooding, is not present in the periphery. So the disease becomes more endemic in the center and responds to flooding here, but not here. And by the way, in the literature, these different seasonalities are generally described for different latitudes, different geographical regions, and happen here within a city, presumably because of the crowding and other factors that facilitate transmission. So from these diarrheal diseases, we see, in my view, very clear evidence for a significant role of climate forcing, a non-linear effect over these multi-annual timescales. But we do see an interplay of climate forcing with epidemiology, not at the longer timescales that we expected, but at the seasonal timescales, and in particular of importance to persistence, so at the opposite end than the depletion of resources. There is the possibility of a more local depletion of susceptibles at the lower spatial scales, and the consequences for these stochastic and spatially distributed systems need to be better understood. I'll return to this later. I have on the right a little bit indicated whether this matches the view of Andreatta and Birch or Nicholson. And of course, it's always a bit of both. But on the spatial structure, I would say that Andreatta and Birch had it right. The extrinsic factors, the socioeconomic and demographic factors, have a very clear signature in the spatial-temporal patterns of disease burden in this megacity. And this, in fact, these factors define the resolution at which we should consider the response to climate. And these large overpopulated cities with pronounced socioeconomic inequality will act as reservoirs of infection and enhance responses to climate, even in infectious diseases that are not climate sensitive to begin with. That is something, anyhow, that we can discuss. But I have my little diagram because I haven't told you where we were in this diagram. And I will propose that for cholera, although we are here in an endemic region, we are still, at, based on the reproductive number of the disease, at the low seasonal transmission end these days. But of course, it depends on the spatial scale, with the possibility that for certain parts of the city and at small spatial scales, we are moving to the right. So I like to now move to a study where it's much more clear where we are in this diagram. And this is malaria in arid regions. And in particular, in these arid regions in the states of Gujarat and Rajasthan in northwest India, for which we were able to put together the records that exist from the surveillance program for the districts of these different states. And in particular, the districts shown there on the right at the edge with Pakistan, these are the most arid districts, where you see these kinds of patterns. Again, very epidemic. The cases are in red, and they follow the monsoons. Not surprisingly, you don't need statistics to tell me that rainfall matters, and I would say that rainfall here was not under discussion. We know that we need rainfall for the rural vectors to recruit. But I like this result, which says not only there is an association with this driver, but it is strong enough to tell us something about the climate itself. So with my climate colleagues, we did this exploration that we like to do to just explore associations with the global oceans, with sea surface temperature in the global ocean, to look at global climate variability and also longer lead times for prediction. And we were a bit surprised that the areas that show significant correlations were not in the Pacific here, but they were here in blue, surrounded by this dotted significance line, in the tropical South Atlantic. And that, that was a bit surprising. But our climate colleagues proceeded to investigate whether there could be a causal link in a model of the coupled atmosphere and oceans with the climate of India. And indeed, at least in the model, there was a connection to rainfall in northwest India, which would explain malaria risk. So this is just to say that in the patterns of malaria, there was information about a climate connection that is not well understood. Now, if you plotted reported malaria cases versus accumulated rainfall, you see, of course, some association, a threshold behavior with some considerable spread. So you can still ask, should we consider population dynamics? Should we bother with immunity at this low transmission end? We, again, encapsulated hypotheses with transmission models. We fitted the models with these very nice methods, and then we could select the best hypotheses, etc. Mainly, I wanted to say that a simple SIR model with some modification to incorporate the vectors did not do a good job, and in fact was much worse, that the more complex model, slightly more complex model, with structure levels of immunity represented by two classes of infectiousness and two classes of susceptibles, where these individuals here in this class are infected but are asymptomatic, and they don't contribute to cases, but they contribute to transmission. Now, when they recover and are bitten again, they are kept in this lower loop, which effectively protects them from disease, clinical disease. So, and then in this model, we have a representation of the mosquitoes as a series of compartments. Most importantly, the transmission rate depends on rain with this threshold, threshold form, and we have seasonality, etc. Now, the main result here with this best model is that this more complex representation of immunity, again, did not have to do with depletion of resources. It had to do with persistence. It mostly helped us explain the troughs, the low levels, the low season, the persistence of the disease during the low season, and this allowed us to better than predict the peaks. And this model outperforms a standard non-mechanistic model that includes rainfall. You can get a sense for the performance of this model by basically, in this figure, comparing the observed cases in red with the simulation from estimated initial conditions. This is a simulation for 30 years forward with the uncertainty in gray, so it's not the next stage prediction, it's just 30 years forward, and you can see that the model does pretty well. We can also evaluate predictability of these models, how good they are for forecasting, and I don't have time to go into this. I mentioned here that they have a high prediction skill for these kinds of districts retrospectively. So if we remove 1 year and predict the season post-monsoon, the prediction skill compares the accuracy of this model to the trivial prediction that after all, September is your average September, etc. This quantity is 1 for maximum prediction. It's 0 when you don't do better than your seasonal prediction. And I have a plot here, of course, of the kind of prediction that matters more, which is going forward, predicting data you have not used to feed the model. And this is for not for falciparum, but vivax malaria and other species that has a more complicated life history. It can basically have a resting state. It has a resting stage in the liver from which it relapses, so you can incorporate that in the models. And I wanted to point out here, with these predictions 1 year ahead in blue, that if you were asking whether the low epidemics had to do with intervention, for this case, you would conclude that no, this model would allow you to tell that the low cases had to do with the rainfall patterns during those 5 years. So you can very nicely consider the effect of intervention in the context of climate variability. But interestingly, this nice association breaks down along irrigation gradients. And these regions of the world are under tremendous change, with land use change bringing large dams, canals, etc. So that the landscape we see in the kinds of districts I was considering before looks like this. And this is how it looks as you move down these irrigation gradients towards more endemic disease, still with epidemics, in the center of Gujarat, the district of Kedah. And you can ask here, well, whether under this kind of development, then climate doesn't matter anymore, or whether we are masking the effect through intervention, since intervention itself depends on wealth, and wealth is produced here by agriculture. I don't have time to go into this. I mainly wanted to make the point that the major control, the main control methods in these regions before the recent times were through indoor residual spraying within the houses. And that is shown in blue here, the population covered. Not surprisingly, the policy basically is one that relates the population cover to cases in the previous 2 years, whether it is by policy or not. This will happen in many systems, so that the perception of risk determines how much is allocated to control. And you see that then, when there have been epidemics, this goes up, and then you consider the problem is gone, you relax control, now climate anomalies hit, and the system is still responding to climate. This is not going to show in a correlation, but there is this interesting cycles, and my graduate student Andres Baeza showed that these cycles can occur and can delay elimination in these systems. So far for malaria, I have told you that there is a very clear signature. Of course, we are in these epidemic regions, a clear signature of climate forcing in epidemic regions. No nonlinear responses in terms of cycles, but we see a depletion. So basically, we see no depletion of the resource at sufficient levels. The competition in this system is still too low at the level of generating cycles that are interannual. However, we still benefit from considering epidemiology. Immunity itself remains important, especially for persistence during the inter-epidemic periods. So again, at the opposite end than where we started with our hypothesis. Now, interannual cycles can indeed be generated if you now consider that intervention in the system is part of your model, because the nonlinear feedbacks that intervention introduces can generate interannual cycles in these systems and interact with climate. So all of that was about places where, after all, there is not much debate that rainfall would matter. But if we move to the highlands, this is where the debate has been really strong. And our work has also shown that interannual variability, now not of rainfall but temperature, is important here. And of course, temperature, because temperatures decrease with altitude, and that limits the population growth of the vector and the development of the parasite within the mosquito. So I will not describe all our work in these regions. I mainly wanted to show you one study that uses interannual variability to say something about climate change and not climate variability. So, climate change, because after all, there have been these very pronounced increases in the size of epidemics from the 70s to the 90s, which have been highly debated. And our study site here is in Ethiopia, south of Addis Ababa, where you have both parasites, falciparum and vivax, which is a bit an exception for Africa, but will be very useful for our conclusions. Well, since we like to think in dichotomies and debates, we have another one here for climate change versus a number of other factors that have also increased with trends. In particular, the preferred hypothesis has been the evolution of drug resistance, the increased frequency in the resistance to chloroquine in falciparum. And to consider the role of temperature and get around this problem of adjudicating or attributing, in fact, trends where you have multiple concomitant trends, we decided to use climate variability and spatial-temporal variation and get around this in the following way. So we considered two regions that for which we had spatial data at high resolution, but starting a bit later than the data on the trends. This is the one in Ethiopia, and then we had a study site also in north of Bogota in Colombia. And this is before the major interventions of the last decade. And what we were after was basically whether there was a signature of a spatial expansion due to warmer temperatures. And this is an example which also shows for Ethiopia the high resolution of the data. There are of the order of 160 administrative units here. For a major El Niño year in 97, going from the trough, from the low season to the high season, with the high prevalence in red, where you see this very clear expansion. So we wanted to quantify this expansion and see how it related to temperature. Again, a signature very much of climate change in other systems in highlands. And here, to summarize at least the descriptive patterns, we basically calculated the cumulative distribution of the cases with altitude. The altitudinal distribution obtained the median. You can do that with another quantity. This is like a center of gravity for that distribution. And I'm showing you here how that median relates to the mean temperature during a critical window of transmission for Ethiopia, Colombia. And it's also interesting to follow this mean altitude in time here in blue, together with the variation from 1 year to the next in temperature. The system is expanding and contracting very, very nicely. A bit more messy here in Ethiopia, where after the big expansion of the large El Niño of 1997-98, a smaller contraction, and then the system expands again during the second El Niño. But what we did here, this after all was about interannual variation, was to say, is essentially the long-term trend for the longer aggregated record, consistent in magnitude with what we would expect from this altitudinal expansion? And the answer is yes. So this phenomenon of expansion can explain at least the magnitude that we see per degree of increase in this longer period at an aggregate level. Now, what about drug resistance? I put here again the two parasites because vivax never developed chloroquine resistance during that period. And you can see that the trend is present in both. So that hypothesis cannot explain this pattern. But critics have said that after all, if temperature matters, what happened at the beginning of the next decade when the epidemics turned around and became smaller? So to ask whether temperature could also explain these patterns, we now went back to our more process-based models, and also because we know that in the last decade, at least in the climate literature, there is a lot of discussion about the slowdown of the warming patterns in temperature. So we wanted to say, what does this imply for malaria? Again, we use a model, we don't need to, similar to the structure model I showed you before, but now the force of infection varies with temperature. And we fitted this model only up to 2000. And then we said, given our best model that considers only temperature, what would we have predicted going forward? That is in blue with its uncertainty in gray. And the main pattern I want you to notice is that for the turnaround at the beginning of the decade, this model predicts that very well. It also predicts the following response to an El Niño. So at the beginning of the next decade, temperature could completely account for what we have observed. Interestingly, too, moving forward, this pattern levels off. This is the slowdown, presumably the slowdown of the warming trend in temperature. Now the data diverge because there was a very strong public health intervention at this point, at this small place in Ethiopia. If you look at the cases for the province, for the whole country in the highlands, you have a leveling off that is consistent with the prediction of this model, because after all, intervention cannot be sustained very, very well in this enormous landscape. So what I'm telling you is that climate change will, without mitigation, of course, result in an increase of the malaria burden in these densely populated highlands of Africa. And I think the evidence is very clear. It doesn't mean other factors do not matter. And indeed, I think that climate has helped the intervention efforts. If the trend had continued, the intervention efforts would have needed to be much stronger. Now, for Ethiopia, having shown this, having this evidence that, after all, temperature matters, we did some simple calculations of how this altitudinal expansion would have acted from the 70s to the mid-2000s, and we estimated a potential addition of 5 to 6 million cases to the national burden in those decades. So, of course, maybe that is small compared to the burden of malaria globally, but it is enormous in this region. Now, to move and end with more theoretical considerations, you can say, all of this was at the left-hand end where you have, after all, you continue to have perhaps sufficiently low transmission that competition did not matter and made the effect of climate very, very clear. But what about moving to the right in regions of higher parasite diversity, higher resource depletion? And of course, here we are talking about strain diversity, strain antigenic diversity in malaria that is enormous, and very interesting questions on how that is structured, how should we capture this in molds, and that does not belong to this lecture. But I wanted to mainly say that we can represent this effect in these more structured molds. On the left, the reinfection molds I showed you before, for example, for rotavirus, where you have multiple levels of immunity, etc., multiple classes, and you need this constant re-exposure for children to transition to protection. In this case, the different strains do not interact directly. You have to recover from one to see the next. But at the opposite end, we have superinfection, where the different strains arrive, and they don't interact at all with each other. Basically, you recover from each independently. The reason I have this here is because, of course, any possible assumption of how these strains interact will be somewhere in between these molds. Now, for superinfection, luckily, some very good mathematicians early on showed that this basically can be captured by simply making the time you stay in the infected class, in the immune class, an increasing function of the transmission intensity. So this is a positive feedback in the system. As transmission intensity increases, you have more people you stay longer in the infected class, et cetera. And for this, we use a model that was developed with David Alonso, who is somewhere here, years ago for a different question. This is a model with more detailed description of the vector, and in particular, we include here the carrying capacity, and it is a model with superinfection. But I wanted to show you that in this model, we ask whether if we drove the carrying capacity, thinking, for example, this is about rainfall, with a seasonal forcing or a period tree, would we see an association in this model with the forcing as we move towards higher transmission intensity, represented here with higher R0. And what you can see for the seasonal forcing in this black line is that as we move to the right, we don't have a confounding effect of the immunity. We, in fact, continue to see a very high association with the forcing, and the same for the period 3. But you can say, well, but there is a drop here, not a huge drop. What happened there? This has nothing to do with cycles. This had to do with a critical transition. So this has, again, more to do with what happens to the system as it moves towards the persistence boundary. towards this bifurcation, towards elimination. And in this work, we showed that consideration of superinfection, of this more complex form of essentially resource depletion, as you increase carrying capacity or biting rate, as you increase transmission intensity in any way, basically led to this critical transition, the kind of critical transition that has been described by Schaefer and others for lakes, essentially tipping points, where you can have a low equilibrium, a high equilibrium, and their coexistence somewhere in the middle. So to summarize this part, well, what do we suggest we will see? This is not a complete study of the question, but what do we expect to see as transmission intensity increases and we have a more structured host population? But basically, what we see is that the role of climate forcing remains apparent. So these more distributed systems continue to basically behave at the temporal scales of the drivers. However, the nonlinear feedbacks introduce the possibility of critical transitions when we push these systems towards elimination. So this behavior has also been seen in models of reinfection, so my guess would be that this is possible in the full spectrum of more complex models. And of course, this kind of transition has implication for the possibility of hysteresis in control efforts, meaning that as you move towards elimination, the efforts would be harder, but also that once you achieve local elimination, local regional elimination, reinvasion would be harder. So they are potentially important. But let me end then back to our historical dichotomy. It will not surprise you if I say that both views were right in some ways, but in different ways than we expected. And I think that the interaction with population dynamics of climate appears much more important in all this persistence behavior than at the high end of resource depletion, which to me is interesting because it's not where we were focusing. And of course that both views were right in some way, because with all dichotomies, after we spend a lot of time arguing and hating each other, we find out that in fact maybe we should have talked earlier to move the field faster. And I should say that, of course, dichotomies are useful to organize how we pose the questions, etc. They are not used when we end up in polarizing debates, which I think continue on some questions on global warming versus socioeconomic development and intervention. I personally think that this interplay of climate forcing and intervention, socioeconomic development, is where we need to concentrate rather than on whether it is one or the other, because we will find in 10 years that in fact, well, both were right. But more importantly, I think this emphasis on persistence and climate forcing leads to basically questions on the creation of new boundaries as we modify these systems. New boundaries and indirect pathways for the action of climate change and variability. In urban environments, where, as I suggested, we may find that diseases that were not climate sensitive may become so, but also with intervention, with successful intervention, as we push endemic systems towards elimination, we will do so, but in different ranges of climate parameters and parasite diversity. And I think this is a fascinating area. We have no clue of what the consequences can be. Dynamically, we expect that we will approach bifurcations, maybe the sensitivity of the system will increase, but we are not doing this in the places where climate is by definition the limiting factors, as I have studied in the previous system. So I think that's an open area. And finally, the strength of competition in these systems will also vary with spatial scale. I didn't have time to develop this idea very much, that in the end, these critical transitions and everything I showed you was with these largely aggregated models, but we know that the kinds of transitions in these stochastic and spatially distributed systems, in which maybe transmission is very fast in the communities that are at high risk, so we have local depletion, but that doesn't make a dent at the aggregated population level in the resource. Well, in those kinds of systems, we may be talking about phase transitions and transitions that are not the kind that these nice deterministic systems imply. So I think that is also an interesting area. We're considering not just the temporal dynamics, but the size distribution of epidemics will be very important at different spatial scales. So let me end by thanking some people, some of you in the audience, in particular Aaron King and Eda Ioannides, without whom this work would not have been possible. My colleague Menno Buma, an explorer of modern time in terms of how you get data. Mohamed Yunus in Bangladesh, completely dedicated to the control of cholera in these different regions. Postdocs Karina Laneri, David Alonso, who has moved on back to Spain, Robert Rayner to Indiana University, and in particular the graduate students, Katia Cole, with whom we started trying to ask these questions, and then other graduate students, including Amir Zirak from Ethiopia. Now, I need to, of course, acknowledge some funding, but in particular, I also wanted to acknowledge some mentors that I will always be very grateful. Thank you, Simon. So, also my mentors in English, but so it's a great pleasure that they could be here. Halka as well, Simon Levine, with my previous advisors, but also very much mentors later on, John van der Meer at the University of Michigan, who I'm not sure wants to talk to me anymore, and Andy Dobson, a very good friend. Thank you very much.
Ordinary way and not by tweeting.
Yes. Yeah, I guess the question was that to some extent these systems are ones with direct transmission, also with vector transmission. What about more complex life cycles, including reservoirs and potential different effects of climate? Yeah, that is a difficult question, but I would say that the question of reservoirs, and perhaps I didn't use that word enough, but the question of the effect of climate on the reservoirs in these systems was also critical. After all, that distributed immunity, what it was doing was creating reservoirs of infection during the low transmission season. And what diversity is doing, the parasite diversity that we should very much try to understand further in terms of how it works in this, how it is structured in this system, it also creates reservoirs of infection. Because after all, the way malaria persists in these very highly endemic regions is by presenting the host with very many different faces. So we are very, very far from the measles paradigm. We don't have a clean consumer resource system because of these reservoirs. And the question of what will happen to the reservoirs as we intervene, as we change the environment, I think those are the interesting questions. But I can't tell you what will happen to your disease. But I think we do have the methods. That's the nice thing. I think that all this discussion created the methods to encapsulate different life cycles. When I started, we couldn't do this very well. In fact, we were limited to SIRS dynamics at the most. Now the limitation is the data, and then how much can you infer from the data? So if, yeah. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, that. So he asked about bringing this kind of knowledge to the sphere of both policy intervention, etc. Right. So I think that there are many ways in which this can be useful, and of course there are in many other diseases very interesting examples of how these molds have, not these, but molds by others have been useful for looking at vaccination, different strategies, etc. I would say here it is useful because, for example, all these systems, when you see change, when you see periods of low, high epidemics, there is no way to know in the context of this very highly variable climate whether what has been the success of intervention. And I think this is useful to actually consider for public health officers, for example, how successful are their measures. I could have shown you that, in fact, you can clearly show that they are doing very well for falciparum in Gujarat, but they are not doing well at all for Vivax. And if you were just staring at this data, you cannot tell. So that is the first thing. The other thing is the challenge of forecasting, which, of course, has been out there for a long time, but I think we can do a better job. And in particular, the open area forecasting in these non-stationary systems. So in a sense, how do we assimilate data as the system changes for our predictions based on retrospective data to continue being valid? I think that's a challenge for forecasting that is important and of course should be part of the picture. But meningitis, an enormous problem in some sub-Saharan Africa, which has been connected to dust, very clear, not the mechanisms are not understood, but very clear associations. Well, the vaccination programs there have nothing, the timing of the vaccination program has nothing to do with what we know about the dynamics. It's just the way it's done and not very successfully. So what if we could use these kinds of models, but in connection to climate, to see whether the window of vaccination should be at a different time. Now, those are just some examples. I would say that the difficult part is that, of course, when you try to bring all of these to the sort of public health people on the ground, and I tried in India, it's not simple, and it's not simple in particular at the times you would most want to work with them, at the time when they think they are doing well with control, so that they think their problem is going away, they don't want to hear what you are saying. And I would love to study that time because it's the critical time towards elimination. And I think we are missing some of that because they lose interest when the epidemics are smaller. So it's not an easy exercise, but it's an interesting one. And I think that the models and the methods are up to the task. I think we need, in particular, and I think we have to lead efforts comparable to the ones you had in genomics, in biodiversity, and others, to basically have much better global data sets of diseases. I don't know how you lead that effort, but I think that's the limiting factor, because we have the tools, but we don't have the data for what we could achieve.